Recording has started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPM, and All GTLD's PDP Working Group call held on the 10th of January, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll calls. We have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, if you could please identify yourself now. And as a side note, we have Brian Beckham noted. Anyone in addition? Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Kathy Kleinman. Please begin.
Thank you very much, Terry. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is Kathy Kleinman, one of the three co-chairs of this working group, as you well know. And I see that my co-chairs, Corwin and J. Scott Evans, are participating in this call as well, as are now 31 participants. So thanks, everyone, for joining. So in this new year, people are switching hats and switching jobs and hopefully getting lots of promotions. So let me pause and see if there are any updates to the statement of interest. Okay, hearing none. And, you know, urging everyone to keep their statement of interest up to date. So now we go to we continue the work that we've been doing with our review of the questions and the topics we'll be looking at for uniform rapid suspension. So I assume staff is uploading the list of topics for review of the uniform rapid suspension that we've been working through. And we've adopted a special methodology for this section where we're looking at high-level questions that will be applying to high-level topics that are kind of high-level summaries of charter questions. So just to remind anyone who might have missed the last few meetings due to the holidays, the high-level questions are numbered 1 through 5. And, again, these are questions to be applied to the topics, and they are, and I'll just read them quickly so everyone has them in front. Has it been used? What was the original purpose, and is it being fulfilled? Bearing in mind the original purpose, have there been any unintended consequences? What changes could better align the mechanism with the original purpose / facilitate it to carry out its purpose, and how many managed to prevail? So not all of these high-level questions are going to apply to all high-level topics. And then we have a draft list under Part 1 of the high-level topics, which we are in the process of reviewing. Last week we looked at, or I guess over the last few weeks, we looked at the complaint, the notice of complaint, the response. Let me ask staff where we ended last week in our discussion. Go ahead, Mary. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. And I believe that we had completed, at least initially completed, the discussion on defenses, and we were at remedies.
Okay. I see this as an open document. Good. So we will continue with remedies. And I'm going to move my document, position my document, down to the Part 2 table. You can look at Part 1 or Part 2. Part 1 is the draft list of the review topics, really the high-level topics that we're looking at. Part 2 is the same topics with the same edits, thank you, staff, same edits have been put in. And it looks at it in conjunction with the charter questions that were asked and kind of shows, it takes the guesswork out of it. You can look at both the high-level topics and the underlying charter questions from which they were derived. And so I would recommend, and I will be starting on page, Mary, is that page 4 or 5 with remedies on Part 2? Is that right? Okay. I'm not sure Mary heard the question. So the top of page 5 for the part 2 table, we're looking at remedies and particularly number 1 under, it's hard to see, number 1, F is remedies, number 1 under scope of remedies. Is there anything anyone would like to add to the scope of remedies in light of some of the questions that we're looking at from the charter and I think from some other locations as well? Let me open up both 1 and 2, scope of remedies and duration of suspension period. Are those both sufficiently broad, and is the coverage sufficiently good for us to move forward? George, go ahead, and then Steve.
George Kirikos for the transcript. Yeah, I think this is probably a section that Claudio would want to insert the suggestion that he was talking about on the mailing list, whether the actual remedies are being implemented properly on the URS. As he noted, there have been occasions where the domain has been renewed and the original registrant regained control of the domain name instead of the domain name going through the natural deletion cycle. So it seems as though this would fit into this category, although Claudio might want to weigh in as well on that topic. Thank you.
George, could you reduce that down to just a few words for me, what you're seeking to add?
Whether the intended remedies are actually being implemented properly.
Mm. Okay. All right. Sounds good to me. And there are some questions that we've heard about problems that registries and registrars have had with implementation. So are they being implemented properly? Okay, and that is captured in our notes now. Steve, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kathy. Steve Levy for the record. Under one of the additional remedies that I would suggest, I found this as a party representative. When the domain is suspended following a URS, it's not uncommon, of course, for the complainant to wish to acquire that domain. And in the current practice, its only option is to put in a back order once the domain expires. I wouldn't mind seeing an option, perhaps in the rules or otherwise, where the parties, the respondent and the complainant, could negotiate a purchase of the domain during the suspension, and that the domain could then be unlocked and transferred if the parties are able to reach an agreement during that period. Thank you.
A very creative idea. Thank you. And I'm going to suggest to staff, obviously we can't do it in real time, that we do have that third column in the table where some of these might be captured, not as questions we've all agreed to, but questions that are on people's minds in the working group, and seems to be lots of open space in the table. So Steve's suggestion about respondent and complainant negotiating a transfer, that's the first time I've heard that. Interesting. Claudio, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kathy. And thanks to George for pointing that out. I guess sort of my point or my comment or my question is whether the remedy is merely suspension, or was the intended remedy, as George mentioned, is the domain intended to expire once it reaches the expiration date? So. It could be that an additional remedy might be cancellation, or it could be that it's an issue whether the remedy is being implemented correctly. So I'm not sure which category it falls in, but as George pointed out, the particular issue is that some of the domains are being renewed, and so just want to make sure we capture that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it sounds like, and I've heard this about domains being some issue with the suspension and also with the extension that is allowed under the URS rules. So it sounds like under scope of remedies, as a review team, it's very appropriate that we'd be looking at both. Is the current mechanism working? Are there problems with implementation as it exists? As George would say, you know, are the remedies being implemented properly? And then a question of, are there additional remedies and options? To summarize, I think what Claudio and Steve just said, are there additional remedies and options that we should be evaluating? Any objections to adding those two details under remedies, under one scope of remedies? Okay, hearing none, I'd like to ask staff to do that, barring any other. Susan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks. It's more a question I have about our process again, and I'm sorry, but I know I keep coming back to this, but I'm still unclear about what our process is. I'm not objecting to what Steve has suggested, for example, at all. I think it seems a really sensible thing for us to consider, but it seems to me that falls within the scope of the remedies. I'm not sure that it needs an addition to this table as such, so much as perhaps it's a good thing for us to capture so that we remember to talk about it when we're talking about scope of remedies. Is that what you meant? I just would like to understand whether we're supposed to be identifying all of the topics at a granular level that we think we need to talk about under these high-level subject matters, because certainly to date that's not how I've been dealing with this, and so I'm concerned if we should have been doing that and we haven't been.
I will respond with my co-chair's hat on, but also, you know, others can respond as well. It's always a good question, Susan, since we are engaged in this special methodology that I know a number of us have been wrestling with for a while. It is my understanding that we have been reviewing the high-level topics to see if there are some high-level sub-points. So under complaint, for example, we had standing to file, grounds for filing, and we added limiting filing period. For notice, we added notice itself and then the subtopics of receipt by registrant and effect on registry operator. So here under remedies, it would seem consistent with the high-level topic to be looking at both the implementation, are there problems with the implementation, which, you know, hearsay would say there are some problems with implementation as the rules currently exist, in which case can we fix them, and then are there additional remedies that might be considered. Susan, if you're still on the call, you're welcome to comment. Otherwise, it would seem consistent to have these subtopics to our high-level topics.
I'm still on the call. I suppose back to what I was saying, though. I mean, the one about implementation, I agree. That seems like a new point three, if you like. I don't know whether it comes after duration of the suspension period, but the one about should there be additional remedies. Doesn't that fall within scope of the remedies? That's all I'm asking. So, you know, should we be getting into that granular level of detail where we want to be identifying the fact that we think scope of remedies includes additional remedies? It seems to me that it already does. I just want to be clear that we know what we're doing.
Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I just said I think proposing additional remedies falls squarely within scope of remedies, and therefore I wouldn't have expected to need to capture it, although I think it's good if stuff comes up in the course of the conversation for us to remember that we want to talk about this in future. Jay Scott's got his hand up. Maybe we should refer to him.
Okay, and I like the idea that there is under remedies F, there is a proposal for number three, implementation or review of implementation. Jay Scott, go ahead, please.
Sorry, I was on mute. This is Jay Scott Evans for the record. I sort of see two points here. One, I agree with the implementation issue. That should go as a subpoint under remedies because that's a different topic, right? And then I would say there might be thoughts that fall within something that's already there that we're not going to put a subpoint, but we just want to remember, and maybe we just put that in our notes. And I'm fine if it's in the chart that just says noted, this type of remedy was mentioned and we should remember to discuss or something to that effect. It doesn't necessarily say that we're going to consider another bucket of issues. It's just when we consider the bucket of scope of remedies, we want to remember that one grain of sand in that bucket is this point, and we document it somewhere so it's remembered when we get there. That's sort of how I would do it. It's sort of a little of both, you're right. Some issues will fall as another topic. Others will be just thoughts that need to be explored when the general topic is concerned, and that would go in sort of a nope area. That would be my suggestion, just to keep it clear and to assist us in retaining memory as we get, because we're going to have to loop back to this at some point, and that could be a couple of weeks from now, and people, you know, their memories may not be what they should be.
J. Scott, while you're still on the line, I don't know if you're looking at the part two table, page five. How do you feel about using that empty space? Maybe it's not what the column heading was for, using that empty space for some of the notes of the kinds of things we're talking about so we keep it all in one place.
You know, I have no concern about where it's documented, but I do think it needs to be incorporated in this short stack of documents that we will use as our working document, rather than just in the meeting notes or just on the transcript. Because I think, you know, having to go back and look at try to recall all the calls that led up to creating this working document is one, overly ambitious and hugely problematic. I think assimilating it all into five or six pages where we have sort of all the information is fine. If we want to use that table two as sort of our discussion topic notes, I'm fine with that. I don't have a thought one way or other.
Terrific. Thanks for your comments. And, you know, as you can tell, I'm a big fan of the at-a-glance kind of look. But the idea that they're all in the same document, so people don't have to reference a transcript, a meeting transcript, or separate notes, great idea. Okay, any other comments on remedies? It looks like we've got both ideas for scope of remedies as well as addition of the three, which probably should be a one, on implementation of current remedies, because we'll probably want to look at implementation of current remedies first and then, you know, how that's working and what additions might be needed. But anyway, any other comments on the high-level topics that we're looking at of remedies right now? Okay, appeal. Again, not discussing appeal itself, but the appeal process, which is currently G, which only has one topic in it now, the appeal process. Phil and then George. Phil, please.
Thank you, Kathy. Phil, for the record, and before commenting on this, in reference to your last question, I think whatever information we can capture in one place is a good idea, so we don't have to refer to multiple sources. On this question as currently posed, I think it needs to be rendered more neutral. By asking how can the appeals process of the ERS be expanded and improved, it presumes that some expansion is justified and that there's deficiencies that require improvement. I think the question has to be much more neutral, something like, should the appeals process been modified? And then for this particular question, the five kind of overarching inquiries on page one kind of work very well. If we just made it a neutral question about should there be any modification of the appeals process, then we could ask, has the appeals process been used? How many people managed to prevail in the appeals process? What was the original purpose of the process? Is it being fulfilled? Have there been unintended consequences? And what changes would better align it with the original purpose? So I think we need a more neutral posing of the question, and then that overarching template, I think, for this particular question would work quite well in giving us relevant answers on which we could make a fully informed and objective decision about whether anything about the appeals process needs to be modified. Thank you.
Phil, hold on. Don't get off here. So the charter question, which may well be biased, is kind of the guideline from which we created the high-level question, you know, the high-level topic, the appeal and the appeal process. Do you, And staff has captured your detailed questions, which belong for further evaluation, definitely. But is there anything you would add under the high-level topic, the appeal process? Is there anything else you want to add there? I'm looking
Not at this time. I really think we just render the base question more neutral and objective, and then ask objective questions to analyze the actual operation of the appeals process. We'll get the right answer.
Okay, so analyze the way it works now and then see what changes are needed.
Yeah, see if it's working. Has it been used? Has it been useful? Any unexpected developments that weren't foreseen when it was created that would require or argue for some modification? That's it.
Terrific.
Thank you.
And happily, our high-level questions at the beginning, paragraph 2 of page 1, the number 1 is, has it been used? Exactly the question that Phil just raised. So it looks like it's okay as written. George, go ahead, please.
George Kirikos again for the transcript. Yeah, I think in this section G for the appeal, we have to differentiate between two different types of appeal. There's the internal appeal mechanism within the URS, where the domain registrant can revive the dispute, so to speak, within, I think, what is it, the six-month period or whatever. That's internal to the URS. But then there's also external appeal, where the either side might want to go to the courts. And so that raises the issue of the availability of court proceedings, whether that assumption in the URS is actually valid, and that's the topic that I brought up to the mailing list before, with the example of the yoyo.email and the other similar kinds of cases, Lufthansa. And so it seems that it would go into that section right now. Because if that assumption is incorrect, then obviously the process should need to be adjusted so that there's no interference with those fundamental rights of registrants. The other point I wanted to bring up was mediation. I don't know whether it should go into this kind of appeal step or somewhere in a different part of the process, but we had a presentation by Nominet where one of the striking statistics, this is in the IGO PDP, where apparently 30% of the disputes were handled successfully simply through mediation. And so that would tend to lower the burden on the entire system if a lot of those cases were simply handled via mediation. So that's something to put in somewhere on this chart. I'm not sure if G is the appropriate part. And then just to go back a step with regards to the yoyo.email, the availability of courts isn't only at play for that scenario, but also for the cases of sovereign immunity that we've been discussing in the IGO PDP, also tribal immunity, sovereign immunity in general, anything where a case doesn't get handled, doesn't get decided on the merits in the courts. That's something that we'd want to discuss. Thank you.
Hmm. Complicated issues. Let me see if I can parse this out for the appeal high-level topic that we're looking at. For the appeal process, I think here we're probably talking about the URS appeal process. There's also a de novo review, which a default registrant can engage in, not an appeal process, a de novo review. And then there's an appeal if someone's upset with the outcome of a URS decision. And then there is the de novo review of the court that can take place if it has jurisdiction outside the URS. So we should be capturing and in fact, we're going to get to a lot of this potential in the next section, H, potentially overlapping process steps. So I think we should make a note about both the appeal and the URS and the, I'm going to put it in quotes, the appeal, because it's not a traditional arbitration appeal, in external courts and courts within the jurisdiction of we'll just call it external courts. So we should make a note of that to come back to. Mediation, staff is captured. We're not sure where it goes. That would take some time. And I think the de novo review is going to be covered in potentially overlapping steps in the next section. And it's interesting about Nominet having a mediation step. Okay, so it looks like the appeal is going to stay broad, the appeal process generally. Susan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not saying we shouldn't have at least some consideration of the notion of mediation. I'm not sure it comes within appeal. I mean, it's an earlier stage of the process. I don't personally care really where it sits, but I'm not sure it sits in appeal. But I think we need to bear in mind when we have that conversation, and I think it ought to be quite a quick discussion, that this process is meant to be a kind of, you know, a quick one for slam dunk cases, and obviously the remedy is not a transfer of the name, whereas of course in the case of the Nominet proceeding, the remedy would generally involve the transfer of the name away from the registrant. So there are, you know, it's a very different process, and having a kind of mediation stage which takes a number of weeks doesn't seem to fit at all within the URS's is, you know, fundamental requirement to be a kind of quick, you know, quick proceeding for slam dunk cases. So I don't object to us having a conversation about it, but I think we need to all be bearing that in mind when we have that conversation, and let's not spend months talking about this in relation to the URS.
Thanks, Susan. I think there is general agreement that mediation doesn't belong in the appeal process section. But happily, I've looked across the table, and it looks like there's a place under N, alternative processes. N1 currently says, and we'll hopefully get there later during this call, possible alternatives to the URS. And there's already one option. Mediation might be something to throw in there as a placeholder should we choose to have that conversation. So let me propose that, that it goes at the very end of the table. Okay. Does anyone else have anything to say about appeal?
This is Brian, Kathy. Can I make a quick observation?
Please.
Thank you. Brian Beckham for the record. I don't know exactly where this fits, but I think it's worth raising when we talk about things like mediation or different aspects of the procedure, especially when we make reference to Nominet or other CCTLDs, to bear in mind that often these processes are subsidized by the registry. And so it's worth bearing in mind when we're thinking about different add-ons to a process, you know, where the cost for that might lie.
That is a very good point, and that's a very good point. Okay. And worth keeping, especially as the URS is designed to be a very low cost, very low overhead as well, set of processes. Okay. H, moving on to H, which is in the middle of page 5, if you're looking at the table in part 2, potentially overlapping process steps. And here we get into some really fun stuff, because there's a potential overlap, and here I'm just reading, concerning duration of the respondent appeal, review, and extended reply periods along the URS process timeline. And so I think the question, my personal opinion is that the summary, this high-level topic summary probably says, you know, summarizes it well, but I will certainly look for other opinions. This is something that we have to look at. It's a little bit complicated between a de novo review of a default judgment and even whether it's been used. You know, one of our things like the others is how has this been implemented? Is it being used? And then are there changes we want to make? Seems to me that might all be captured in kind of the way it's phrased right now. But I pause for other comments and urge people to look at the charter questions in the table from which this has come and some of the other issues that were raised in Abu Dhabi, which is just that there are various mechanisms involved here for additional reviews and appeals. Okay. So it looks like that remains unchanged, barring anything we might hear on the list. Bottom of page 5, I, cost. And this is looking at the cost allocation model. And now there's a question that came in the charter. Is the cost allocation model for the URS appropriate and justifiable? And there are other questions in the charter as well. But the high-level question is cost and the cost allocation model and our analysis of the cost allocation model. Does anyone want to add or change this high-level topic, which has only this one subpart? Claudio, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. Yeah, I mean, the only thought I had here was this could be combined with fees. I think fees is currently described as response fee, and it could be just labeled fees, and it might capture both of these issues. Or we could leave it out. I mean, there's probably no harm in having it as a separate topic. Thanks.
Certainly a note should be made that that there is an issue under response. C3 is the response and response fee. I think that's what Claudia is referring to. So probably a reference to that note regarding responses. If anyone doesn't have any objection, it may be worth just keeping the table as is to go forward, unless you strenuously object, Claudia, with that reference so that we can look at the overlapping issues.
That's totally
okay.
Fine.
Terrific. Anything else on cost? Okay. Moving on to page 6, language. Jay.
Kathy, Phil here. I put my hand up on cost.
Phil and George are in the queue. Okay, go ahead, please.
Yeah. In regard to the last question, how can costs be lowered so end users can easily access RPMs? Again, I'd like a more neutral formulation, something like how can costs be lowered and what would be the impact of doing so. I'm not against lower costs if they're achievable and that would facilitate greater access to this RPM, but I think you also have to look at how that might impact the quality of decisions. It's already at $500 considering administrative costs and use of experts and intellectual property. I'm not sure how much more room there is for lower costs, but I think if you're going to look at that, you have to look at would that adversely affect the quality of the process. So that was my comment there.
So, Phil, would a broader question be kind of should costs be lowered?
Could be, I mean, or just can costs be lowered and what would be the effects? But something that's more, that looks at more than just end user accessibility. Obviously, if, you know, if I can subsidize the cost, that would be fine, but that has other impacts. But it just has to take into consideration more than just one effect of lower costs.
Good. And it looks like staff is capturing that. Thank you. And David McCulley has phrased as well, are costs appropriate? Thanks, Phil. Jay Scott, go ahead, please.
This is Jay Scott Evans for the record. A couple of things. One, I think there's a difference between how fees should be split and are they appropriate and that kind of stuff. But I think it's very difficult, and we found in the RRT is – you know, you can have all the opinion you want about cost, but that's a business decision that's based on the provider and what the costs are. We suggested it should be low cost. I think we originally said $250 or something like that, but you can't set costs. So I wonder if that's not a waste of time and we should move on from lesson learned. Now, it's a different question if we want to ask the question is whether we think ICANN should subsidize something and how that might affect costs. But I don't think – I wonder if we're wasting our time having a discussion that was thoroughly vetted before. And it, at the end of the day, it's a business determination by the provider. And we're not going to have any effect on that business determination. Now, we can say it should continue to be low cost. But I just think it's very difficult, and you're just going to spend a lot of time talking about something where I think we'll have very little effect. I note that Jeff is agreeing with me because he was in those ROT meetings. We went round and round and round on this. And trust me, the constituency that I represented at the time, the intellectual property constituency, was most interested in it being as low cost as possible. So I'm just saying that even with that interest, I think that focusing in on that could be time not well spent when we're up against a deadline. The addition of whether there should be a fee shifting or that kind of thing, regardless of what that fee would be, is a different issue. And that certainly could be explored because you're not talking about the amount, you're just talking about allocation. So just wanted to raise that as a bit of history for those on the call.
Thank you, Gayscott. As you know, I think history is always important. So fee shifting, fee setting, and not going back into discussions that were decided long ago may make sense. And also just implementation. How is it working out? What fees have been set, and how's the cost recovery, and are we getting the panelists that we need on this? So just broad. Thanks for the background. George, you keep shifting down. I don't know if that's a new hand or an old hand, but I've seen your hand up for a while, and Susan's hand is up as well. I'm going to go in the current order that I see, which is Susan and George, but George, if there's a problem with the room, let me know. Susan, please.
Yeah, thanks. Only really quick. I agree with what Jayscott was just saying around that lowering of cost and obviously the need for, you know, the providers to be, you know, running this as, you know, they are running it as a commercial enterprise, and so, you know, we can't be setting a fee, but I think if we're talking about this section on costs overall, there obviously there are other topics within that overarching topic that are still worth considering. And they, as Claudio said, kind of somewhat go into the question about response fee. It's about the cost allocation model. I'm keen we don't lose the consideration of the cost allocation model because we don't want to talk about what the level of cost should be. So I think that's a really long-winded way, of saying I think we still do need this section on cost, but I agree with what Jayscott's saying about we shouldn't be looking at the level of the cost, if you know what I mean.
Great. Thank you for the comments, Susan. I'm going to note that Mary wrote that staff, when consulting with Heather about the topic listing, assumed that all of these points will be raised and discussed under the actual topic of, quote, cost allocation, close quote, in this case. So, but staff is further capturing the notes of this discussion for different issues and items we should be looking at in more detail when we get to these high-level topics. Thanks, Susan. George, go ahead, please.
George Kratos, sorry for raising my hand, lowering it a few times. It was changing my mind depending on who was speaking, whether to add input. Two points I wanted to make. First, the costs seem to be focused only on the registrants or ICANN subsidizing the model. Conceivably, the registry operators and or registrars might be parties that we could look to for costs, the reasoning being that we want to likely focus recovery of the costs on the parties that are most responsible for generating the costs. So you can conceive of scenarios where certain registrars or certain registries have an above average number of abuse claims. And so it might make sense that those parties are somewhat responsible for the fees involved. I'm not going to name any names, but we can probably think of that. It's a bit controversial, obviously. And Susan says they'll pass it on to their customer, but that's good then, because if there's higher costs for those customers that are causing abuse, then that's self-policing. The other point I wanted to make was that the contract with the TMCH providers apparently allowed ICANN to audit the accounts of the TMCH provider in order to see if the profits that they're generating are excessively high. And I think I've already asked for a copy of the TMCH contract to see whether ICANN has ever actually implemented such an audit. I don't think they have, but that's obviously gone unanswered by ICANN staff. Ms. PDP, I might have to do a DIDP request. But assuming that that clause actually exists, then conceivably that kind of clause could be inserted into the providers of the ERS and or UDRP, giving ICANN some oversight into looking at their books to make sure that they're not making excessive profits from being the providers. Thank you.
Hold on, George. Let me see, because it looks like we need a note to be captured on the right side. So you're looking at – you're raising a question of – which may or may not be appropriate in this section, but what's the oversight of any of the providers by ICANN?
No, I think ICANN had the right to audit the TMCH provider. I think it was mentioned in either Fadi Chahadi's.
No, URS providers.
This is the TMCH providers.
Right.
And so one could apply similar logic to the URS and or the UDRP, that they would have the right to do a similar analysis to make sure that there's no...
I'm not sure that's the case, because ICANN has contracts with the TMCH providers. But it sounds like you want to raise the general question? What is the oversight, if any, by ICANN of the URS providers? Because I'm not sure we know what it is.
It could broadly go into that, but I think they specifically had a clause in the TMCH that they were allowed to audit the TMCH provider. It was either
they can audit the TMCH provider
to make sure the profits were not excessive. It's not clear they've actually ever done so, but I think it was in the blog post by Fadi Chahadi back when the current TMCH provider was given the contract.
Okay. Mary has noted that the MOUs with the URS providers are published, and she's also captured a question that we think probably covers the important issue that you just raised, or the important question you just raised. Thanks, George. Okay. Cost allocation model, probably done with that. Should we go on to language, something that we spent a lot of time looking at? J, language, and we are now on page 6. Let me move my – I'm working with multiple documents here. A lot of questions about language, English-oriented barriers to barriers to access to the proceeding. You can see them in the charter if you're looking at the Part 2 table. They've been encapsulated into J1 language issues, comma, including current requirements for complaint, notice of complaint, response, determination. So kind of that high-level overview of where language might come into play, what's currently happening, or as the first high-level question says, has it been used, what's happening, and then broadly what we might want to do. Does anyone want to add or change J1 as it exists in the table right now as a high-level topic? Okay. Yeah, I think it captures both the notes of the last meeting and a lot of the discussion that we've been having. Okay. I'll pause for a second. Okay. K, abuse of process. And there are three subpoints that have been captured as part of the high-level discussion. One, misuse of the process, including by trademark owners, registrants, and, quote, repeat offenders. Two, forum shopping. And three other documented abuses. So this is a broad question. Abuse of the process was an issue with the drafting of the URS. A lot of people gave a lot of thought to it to try to see if we could prevent abuse of process by all participants and kind of keep this as the narrowly focused, what Susan said, clear cases of abuse. Does this high-level question and its subpoints cover broadly the issues that we want to look at? It looks broadly like it does, and we'll wait to see if other people and others, including people on this list, want to comment when we get to the want to comment on the list once the edited table comes out. Okay, moving on to L, education and training, which has one subtopic: responsibility for education and training of complainants, registrants, registry operators, and registrars. By way of background, others have noted that the URS is different than the UDRP. This is a mechanism implemented by the registries, not the registrars. There seems to be some issue of concerns and problems in education in that area, and we've also heard about registrant and complainant issues of education as well. Does anybody want to add anything? I'll pause if people look at some of the charter questions from which this high-level topic was extracted. George, go ahead, please.
George Kirkos, I just wanted to note for the record that I posted information regarding the YouTube dispute resolution procedure for the DMCA, and they had some useful insights into how they conduct education. They have like a copyright school that people could take a course on, or they're actually forced to take a course on if there's a complaint against them. And so we could perhaps learn a little bit from there in terms of their learning management system, and might want to implement some of that either for the pre-dispute training or in some cases post-dispute training. If somebody was found to have abused the process, for example, then education might be required before they can file another dispute. Thanks.
Terrific, George. Thank you. Thank you for posting it in the list and using our list for discussion, which is great. Staff have captured it. We may want to capture other models as well. Are there other models of education that we should be looking at without going too far down that path? You know, do other things easily come to mind that would serve as good models? Okay. Anything else on education? Zach, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. Zach Muskowitz for the record. I'm wondering whether under this section it would be appropriate to also reference training for panelists or guidance about policy interpretation for panelists. I mean, we could capture it under the general description of education training, of course, but perhaps it's worth a mention as well. Something like a consensus view could be discussed ultimately under that heading. Thank you.
Sorry, Zach, stay on the line. I was with you until you said consensus view. What are you referring to there? I definitely understand the panelist training issue. But go ahead.
Okay, so for example, the education and training questions as they're listed now under that heading, as ICANN doing this job, or the providers training both complaints and response, I don't see any specific reference to training of panelists. And as we know, in the UDRP, WIPO conducts regular training sessions for panelists. It also writes and publishes the WIPO consensus view on issues, UDRP interpretation issues. And so there is potentially an opportunity to investigate that as for the URS as well.
Terrific. Thank you. Great suggestion. Training for panelists, which may fit here or it may fit in the next section, but something absolutely to be held because we want to make sure everyone's trained across the board with this process. Thanks, Zach. Important contribution. Anyone else want to comment on education and training before we move forward to what may now be an overlapping topic with the URS providers? Okay, we can certainly come back to education and training. On to M, URS providers, and it has one subpoint: evaluation of URS providers and their respective processes. And I'm pausing because we have both charter questions as well as a co-chair's memo. So, Phil, would this be an appropriate time for us to jump to the co-chair's memo, or would you like to wait to discuss it later?
Yeah, Kathy, can you hear me? I'm off mute. You know, I think the co-chair's proposal was meant to take these questions and get to some of the same inquiries in a more objective and data-based fashion. But just as an administrative matter, it might be best to just look at these now, finish this chart. We're near the end here, and then go to the I'd hate to jump to the co-chair's memo and not complete what we're doing here.
Okay, terrific. So, okay, so then continuing along the line, we've got, this is our third to last point. So, URS providers, subpoint one, evaluation of URS providers and their respective processes. If you look at the table, there is a question of the backgrounds of URS providers and their preparations. Are the processes being adopted by the providers, you know, fair and reasonable? You know, are they consistent with the rules? What changes need to be made to ensure, you know, that they're consistent with ICANN policies, et cetera. So these were abstracted to the high-level topic. And at sub point, any changes that people want to propose? George, go ahead, please.
George Kirkus with the transcript. Yeah, I'm not sure if it belongs in this section or somewhere else, but the way I look at it is that the URS providers serve a more administrative role. What's more important is actually the role of the panelists. And so if we consider the panelists to be akin to judges, who are the panelists actually accountable to, and how are problematic panelists dealt with? Is that going to be part of our, you know, we have oversight over the providers, but don't have, and they only have the oversight over the panelists? Or should ICANN be taking a more direct approach with the panelists? So I don't know whether it should go into this M or whether it should go somewhere else, but if there are problematic panelists, that needs to be part of the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, George. No, that seems like an appropriate comment for this section, URS providers, and accountability of the panelists and oversight of the panelists. So that's been captured by staff. Anything else to add kind of broadly to the URS provider review at the high level? And Christine notes, providers are required to train panelists. They are not required to train complainants and respondents. Peter notes that there are yearly meetings with both URS and UDRP panelists with updates, education, et cetera, on cases and policies. Okay. So, and actually, happily, I miscounted, and we are on the last item, which is N, alternative processes. And we have one subpoint, possible alternative or alternatives to the URS, e.g. summary procedure in the UDRP. And this is probably where we might add the mediation section that was on. Alternative processes, and this seems to arise from a question that came, I think, in Abu Dhabi. The more general question, should there be some kind of alternative to the URS, such as the summary procedure in the UDRP? Any other subpoints for the alternative processes? Then I think we have made it, at least for this group in this meeting, subject to review of our much larger membership online, through the list of topics for review of the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, with thanks to staff for working through this. And Jay Scott and Phil, and this is a lot of work to kind of review and abstract these high-level topics out of the more detailed material that we were given in the charter. Claudio, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. Sorry, I should have jumped in earlier. Two additional topics that I thought of that might not be captured here. One is the way that default procedures work. I'm not sure if we have that as a separate topic, and also the administrative review that is, I believe the providers conducted an administrative review, so that might fall under one of the existing areas, but those were, I was just brainstorming, and those are the two that came to mind.
Sorry, the administrative review
of the complaint.
Meaning the first pass review when
yeah.
it gets to the provider?
Exactly.
Okay.
And the other one was default, the way the default procedures are structured.
The administrative review, that may be a comment. Stay on the phone if you would, Claudia. Suggested topic A, the complaint, would seem to be the place for the administrative review of the complaint. Does that make sense all the way up at the top of the table?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. That could fall
okay.
in there. Maybe we just note it as a note.
Okay.
And for default procedures, where do you think that one would fall?
That's a good question. Let's raise that to the group as well, including to those who have studied this table closely and memorized it, because I'm sure there are people in the group who have. I think it would probably fall under response, C, the response. Currently C2, other issues related to the response.
Okay.
If anybody disagrees, so in this case, it's a non-response.
Yep.
But I think it's important. Let's make, if staff could make a note about this, about default procedures and where the closer inquiry would go and whether a note should go into C2 about defaults and that section where we're holding notes about, in addition to the response. Okay. Thank you, Claudia. Terrific. Okay, so we've wrapped up the table for the moment, at least. We may revisit it, but it gives us a framework for our upcoming discussion and data gathering on the URS. Terrific. Congratulations, and thank you. Now I'm going to go briefly through the other general charter questions. I'll just read them because I'm not sure how much the question will be how we incorporate them, and I'm not sure how much we want to debate them now. But we have a half hour to talk about the co-chair statement on URS review that we've been asked several times to talk about. So I'm glad we have half an hour to do it. So let me briefly read the other general charter questions. Which is, I'm on page 8 of part 2. So things that didn't seem to quite fall within the main table, the main high-level topics. Do the RPMs adequately address issues of registrant protection, such as freedom of expression and fair use? Will, and if so, to what extent, changes to one RPM will need to be offset by concomitant changes to the others? So a percolation issue. Do the RPMs collectively fulfill the objectives for their creation? In other words, have all RPMs in the aggregate been sufficient to meet their objectives, or do new or additional mechanisms or changes to existing RPMs need to be developed? So kind of a high-level question that came in from the charter. Should any of the new DTLD program RPMs, such as URF, like the UDRP, be consensus policies applicable to all GTLDs? And if so, what are the transitional issues that would have to be dealt with as a consequence? We'll definitely be looking at that. Our recent and strong ICANN work seeking to understand and incorporate human rights into the policy considerations of ICANN relevant to the UDRP or any of the RPMs. Broad level questions, I'm not sure we have to argue about them now, but things that we've agreed to keep in mind and keep within our table. Anybody wants to comment? We'll pause.
Brian, I have a comment.
Sure, go ahead.
I must say, I'm not entirely clear what the purpose of this statement is. To me, all of the editorials and questions that are raised are already captured in the various charter questions, high-level questions, what have you. So I think it's pretty uncontroversial, but I guess I'm just struggling to see what it adds that's not already on the table.
Interesting. Does anyone want to It's a good question. Does anyone want to comment on that? Phil, go ahead, please.
Yeah, Kathy, could you just clarify the statement just Brian just made? What is he referencing? Is that the general charter questions or the co-chair statement?
I think he's referencing the general charter questions.
Okay.
No.
I'm talking about this co-chair statement. In other words, I believe that the charter questions already capture these questions that are in this co-chair statement. So I guess my question is, if that's right, if our charter questions already capture these questions, I guess it's just not clear to me what this is meant to add in our deliberations.
Oh, my apologies, Brian. I thought you were commenting on what I just read. If you're commenting on the co-chair statement, if you don't mind, let's do that in order. Let's ask Phil, if that's okay, to present the co-chair statement. And then we can talk about whether it belongs or it's duplicative, but I think maybe we should present it first and just discuss what it is.
Okay, Kathy, I think you just volunteered me to present it, but I don't have a problem with that. But I'd like to respond generally to Brian first on his question. Now, what's the purpose?
Sure.
I think there's, to my mind, I'm speaking personally now, because other co-chairs may have different views on this or additional views. When you look at the questions regarding in section M on page 7, URS providers, evaluation of URS providers, number one, the co-chair's proposal is meant to largely substitute for these questions, which I find personally these questions to be subjective, somewhat biased, and not leading to clear answers. When you look at, are the processes being fair and reasonable? Fair and reasonable are subjective terms. Are they fair and equitable in the next question? What changes need to be made to ensure that starts with an assumption that changes need to be made? That procedures adopted providers are consistent, so there's an inherent assumption that they're doing things that are inconsistent. They may or may not be, but the questions have biases built in. Are providers exceeding the scope of their authority? Now, the authorities in the procedures, the rules, and the MOU, so it's better to start there and seeing if they're adhering to it. The last question, what remedies exist or should exist to allow questions about new policies, that in a way assumes that there's new policies being adopted ad hoc by providers. So, and before we go through the actual proposal from the co-chairs, a major purpose is to take all those subjective questions and substitute instead very objective questions, saying we have, for the providers, for this new RPM, we have rules, we have procedures published by ICANN for implementation of the rules, and we have an MOU, which is a rudimentary contract, which levies other requirements on them, and these run the gamut from expertise of panelists to things at their website, and let's just see if they're complying with that, and then we can decide. One, are they compliant? That's a very objective inquiry. It's not starting with some bias, or it's starting with the fact that the rules reflect the consensus reached when this RPM was created. The procedures were adopted to implement those rules, and the MOU is out there. It's a fact that the three providers have all agreed to adhere to that MOU. So let's start with what the requirements are and see if the providers are adhering to them. Now, I think we'll find to the large part they are, and to where they're not, that there are ready fixes for that. But let's have an objective criteria before we go wandering off into subjective areas. Second, this inquiry is extremely relevant to the general charter question about should any of the new TLD program RPMs, such as URS, be consensus policies applicable to all GOTs, actually not just applicable, but required to be implemented and followed by all GTLDs, including legacy GTLDs that existed long before the new TLD program. We could have complete agreement on the policy of the URS, but when you talk about applying this policy, taking a policy that's been applied, and we're really just talking about the URS and the DRP that we reviewed early on. Obviously, Sunrise and trademark claims is not relevant to legacy TLDs. We could all be in agreement on the elements of the policy, but if you're talking about applying it to 150, 160 million legacy domains, you want to also, particularly if you're a legacy registry operator, want to be assured that the policy is being followed by the people administering it. And finally, not to jump ahead, but we do know that one of the questions before us in the UDRP review is whether they should be UDRP providers should be subject to some standard agreement. Well, here we have RPM providers subject to a standard agreement in the form of an MOU. So looking at their compliance or noncompliance with that and whether that works as a way to get some uniformity of administration would inform that aspect of our UDRP inquiry when we start getting to that next year. So I'll stop there. That's just an overview. I see a lot of hands up, so I think before getting into the actual specific elements of what the co-chairs have proposed, I should stop there with that general overview. But again, the main point is to substitute for the subjective questions that we have now much more objective questions based on compliance with the actual requirements for proprietors, which will, and then based on the answers to those questions, we'd be in a better position to judge whether the URS should be a consensus policy applicable to legacy TLDs, and we'd also know more about the use of an MOU or some type of standard agreement with DRP providers. So I'll stop there and look forward to hearing from those who have raised their hands. Thank you.
But I know there's a queue, but I'm only on audio, so could I just put myself in the back of the queue, Brian?
Terrific, Brian. Thank you. I'll put you after Claudio. Okay, this is Kathy, of course, and Phil, thank you for the overview. We did not point to where the document was. This is a document that runs the bottom of page 8. If you're looking at the materials online, all of page 9, and then there's a bit on the top of 10. And so, and this is looking at the URS providers, and as people said by way of background, the URS providers were, the idea was to have a closer relationship with the URS providers than we had, than we created about 20 years ago with the UDRP providers. And, you know, it's an interesting question. Is that working out? John, go ahead, please.
Thanks, John McElwain, for the record. So I was going back and looking at the working group charter, and the first bullet point of the other general charter questions and the last bullet point are not contained in that. I don't necessarily have a huge problem with it, but I just wanted to point that out since it's being referred to as...
Sorry, the first bullet point and the last bullet point.
Yeah, so do the RPMs adequately address the issue of registrant protection, and then are recent and strong ICANN work seeking to understand and incorporate human rights? Those are not contained in at least the version I'm looking at from our working group charter. So just point that out. But my main question is... what are you asking us to do with other general charter questions? Just sort of putting a pin in keeping these topics in mind when we go over the more specific ones. I just wasn't clear on A, why extra bullet points were added, and B, what we were supposed to do with these. And I'll listen for a response. Thanks.
I will give you my response, although this does – and we've actually got two conversations now on the table. One is the question of the URF and how we're looking at the providers with the co-chair statement, and the other is looking at other general charter questions, which I really had read because it was in our materials, because I didn't want to skip over it before we got to the providers discussion. But Mary has looks like she has an answer to the question. Thank you, Mary. I'm glad you do.
Thanks very much, Kathy, and thanks to John for raising the question, because maybe we needed to clarify it before now. So you're correct that in the charter, in the early part of the charter questions, there is a set of three bullet points labeled general, and that includes the question of the objectives, whether they're fulfilled collectively, and whether any of the phase one RPM should be consensus policies and so forth. That's then followed by a listing of specific issues specific to particular RPMs, and at the very end, there is a section that is called additional questions and issues. This is the, a residual category of questions that were brought up by the community. And again, none of these questions in the charter were edited in any way, but these did not necessarily fit for charter purposes either within an overarching issue as in the first three bullet points in the general section, and of course they also were applicable to more than one RPM. So for purposes of the charter, those were put into a separate section at the end called additional questions. For purposes of this review of the URS for compiling this table, rather than have two separate general sections, what we simply did was to combine the overarching questions with the additional general questions, and that's what you see as the five or six bullet points at the bottom of this page following the table in part two. So we haven't added anything that wasn't in the charter. We actually also haven't taken out anything that was in the charter that was a general question.
John, I'm going to pause a second. This is Kathy, in case you want to come back on and follow up.
Yeah, so it wasn't focused so much on whether it was contained somewhere else, because I think it certainly is topics we've been raising, but I'm just kind of wondering, what are we supposed to do with the other general charter questions? Are we adding them, or is this staff identifying these are issues that weren't identified in the URS analysis that they're suggesting that we add? I'm just trying to figure that out.
I think to summarize what Mary said, Mary, is that a new hand?
Yes, it is, but please go ahead, Kathy.
Okay. I think, and me personally, I think what Mary said was that we're trying not to drop anything. The staff created a special place for things that didn't fall directly into the chart but appeared to be applicable from the charter to the URS discussion, even if they didn't mention the URS directly. So I think it's a kind of a holding area, things to keep in mind to make sure they don't get lost at the end of the day. But I turned to Mary because I was trying to summarize her words.
Thanks, Kathy, and that's exactly right. And the point being that for some of the other RPMs in the TMCH a part of it, or possibly Sunrise or Claims, there were some questions in the charter that had been moved around because they were found to belong more properly to another section other than what was listed. So as Kathy says, we just didn't want anything to be missed. It's not for staff to suggest that this should be added to the URS. It did occur to us that these questions are more general in nature in the sense that they're applicable to more than one RPM. So in considering any particular RPM, either during its consideration or as the staff suggested, perhaps after you're done with all the RPMs, remembering that the URS is the last RPM for phase one, it would be good to look at these remaining general questions to see if anything's been missed and if anything else needs to be done. Thanks, Kathy.
Terrific. Thank you, Mary. We'll go on to George, Susan, Claudio, and Brian. George, go ahead, please. And if people could speak quickly, we are in our last 15 minutes. Thank you.
Yeah, George Corcus for the transcript. Yeah, my question relates to what John was saying. In terms of our work plan, we had decided to divide the work into phase one and phase two. And if the URS falls into phase one, some of the issues related to the URS are interrelated to the UDRP. So I'm not clear, are we planning to have preliminary recommendations with an asterisk that are subject to review after we do the UDRP phase two work? Because, for example, if we look at N on page 8, whether there should be some kind of alternative to the URS, which is perhaps a merger of the URS and the UDRP into a single DRP. If that happens, you know, would we do the UDRP review and then circle back to the URS review for a second round? Or I'm not exactly sure how it all works in our work plan. Thanks.
Okay. It's a good question, George, and I don't and I'm going to answer it as an individual, and people can feel free to contradict. Phase one definitely closes with the URS. Because we have to get that, we have to get the URS, the Sunrise Period, Trademark Claims, Trademark Clearinghouse, out to Subsequent Procedures Working Group, co-chaired by Jeff Newman, so that we can work on the new applicant guidebook. So my guess would be that if there are recommendations from the URS to the UDRP, those will be recommendations we take up in phase two as we do the full UDRP review. That they might be deemed as suggestions or strong recommendations, however we might choose to phrase it. But two different phases have to have a bright line between them because of our need to report to the Subsequent Procedures Working Group. People should feel free to contradict me if they don't agree. Claudio and then Brian. Claudio, please.
Thanks, Kathy. I'll be quick. I know we're getting towards the end of the call. So I think some of the points in this co-chair statement I think are helpful, and I understand I think where the co-chairs were coming from with some of this, particularly the first couple of bullet points. But I think along the same lines of what George just mentioned, I wonder if this, because there's a line here that says these are among the major questions to be dealt with towards the conclusion of phase one, and I wonder if questions such as do the RPMs collectively fulfill their objective, if that's something that should be done towards the end of our work. So that was just a question I had there.
You're talking about towards the end of phase two?
Correct.
3 years from now or 15 years from now or whenever we get there.
Right, because, I mean, this bullet point says if they're collectively fulfilling their objectives, and so I'm just assuming that that's a question that's going to incorporate the review of all of the RPMs. And so I'm just not sure if we can answer that at the end of phase one. And then as you get towards the bottom, some of the bullet points there about the URS providers seem much more specific, and they seem like points that could be raised on the URS provider section that we have in the chart. And I think one of the questions I just have one of the bullet points I have a question about whether it would be in scope, the third bullet point about have the URS decisions been limited to cases meeting the clear and convincing standard and been properly explained. But again,
what page are you on, Claudia?
The third bullet point at the end of the co-chair statement.
Okay, so page 9.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. And I'm sorry, now that I'm looking at it, that we're all looking at it, could you raise the question again?
Sure. The question was whether that type of analysis is in scope of our review. I'm not sure exactly. I think this bullet point would need to be fleshed out a little more. I'm not exactly sure what that's getting to there or how we would answer that specific question. But again,
okay.
Basically, all the bullet points at the end, I just feel like these could be included in the chart under under the provider section. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you for that comment. And Phil is in the queue, but not next because it's Brian. So Thank you for the comments and the inclusion of these into, I believe it's section M for provider. Brian, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. Brian Beckham for the record. I think I have a lot to say, frankly, on Phil's summary of these questions, but maybe I'll just ask one question, which I think is probably most pertinent to the path forward for this working group, which is certainly I, and I know other working group members, have been proceeding on the understanding that the fact that this is a working group that has been formally convened through a GMSO resolution, that any work product that comes out of this would result in a consensus policy. So for me, the question of whether the URS would become a consensus policy if it were recommended by this working group, the answer is a fairly obvious yes, but maybe before we get too far down the road, it would be worth asking the staff if there's some clear guidance on whether that assumption is correct, because that may impact people's participation and views in the working group. Thanks.
Okay. I will wait for Mary to raise her hand because it is a staff question that you directed. But, Brian, I just wanted to say that it's my understanding that's a separate evaluation. As we look through the mechanisms, phase one is about mechanisms created for new GTLDs, and that at the end of this, one of the questions is it our advice to go forward with these for all GTLDs versus, say, the next round of new GTLDs? There would be historic, you know, there are historic issues on this one. Mary, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy, and thanks, Brian. We just wanted on the SCAF site to clarify what Brian's exact question was. We gather that it was about the URS and consensus policy, but we apologize that we didn't actually get the specifics. So if he wouldn't mind repeating it, we'll try to answer it.
Sure. So the question is, if this working group recommends that the URS become a consensus policy applicable to all top-level domains, is there anything additional that would be required? Perhaps I'm misunderstanding the way that Phil had characterized the co-chair statement, but I understood that there seemed to be some kind of a question lingering as to whether this working group's recommendations would result in a consensus policy. I appreciate the history that the URS was developed specifically for the new GTLD program, but that is history, and as I've understood, the work of this working group is directed towards producing recommendations that would become consensus policies applicable to all top-level domains. So the fact that the URS was initially developed as an implementation tool for new GTLDs is, in a sense, neither here nor there. But again, it seems to me that there's a question as to whether that's correct, or what? In other words, the way I understood Phil's summary was that even if this working group recommends that the URS would be applicable to all TLDs because it's a consensus policy, that there would still be some additional, requirement or an additional working group to be convened or something. I don't know if that helps clarify.
That does, Brian. Let me check. Happily, Phil is also in the queue next. Mary, did you want to respond and then Phil or vice versa?
So just really quickly, Kathy, so the answer, Brian is correct, obviously, that we are looking at consensus policies in a PDP, and one specific potential outcome from this particular PDP is the possibility that the URS and any other of the phase one RPMs could be recommended to become a consensus policy applicable to all GTLDs, including legacies. So specifically, what would happen then, assuming that the council and then the board accepts that, you know, at the moment, hypothetical recommendation, an implementation team will have to be formed, which is comprised of community members working with our GDD colleagues. So what could happen at that point would be there may need to be considerations as to when the policy would be considered effective, whether there's additional work that would need to be undertaken with legacy registry operators versus new GTLD registry operators, since some legacies have the URS as a contractual requirement right now, but not as a consensus policy, and others have neither. So that would be the next phase of the work, if that helps. Thanks, Kathy.
Mary, thanks. And to whoever's writing the notes, if you could label, the question came from Brian, the answer came from staff, so it might be worth noting where the answer starts and that this was a staff answer. That might be useful to people who are going to be reading the notes in the future. Thanks. Phil, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. I'll be brief in view of the late time here. Just to address Brian, to the extent I'm a little confused by his question, but my understanding is that the task before this working group, not some other working group, is to evaluate the URS, whether it's working as intended, whether it needs to be changed in any way, and then the question of whether it should be, we would recommend that it become a consensus policy and therefore a requirement for legacy TLDs. Is a separate question before this working group that will probably be addressed by the conclusion of phase one of our work. So there's no presumption that it will become consensus policy or that it won't. It's a question before this working group based in significant part upon our evaluation of its effectiveness and any issues we find with it. The reason I jumped in to the queue originally was the question George has raised, which is the relationship of our work on URS to any expedited rapid form of the UDRP that we might consider in phase two of our work, the UDRP review. I'm not the sole authority on this. I think it's up to the working group, but I think from my point of view, personally, the only way it can work is that we review the URS now, propose any changes we think are required, decide the consensus policy question, and then when we get to the UDRP, substantially informed by our review of this rapid response mechanism, we can decide whether something similar should be made part of the UDRP to either supplement the URS or it could substitute for the URS based on further considerations. And that, of course, would be a consensus policy, any change in the UDRP. Others may have a different view. That was my answer on that question. I'll get out of the way so Susan can speak before we hit the end of the time. Thank you.
Terrific, Phil. Thank you for responding to both sets of questions. Susan, the last word is yours.
Thank you. It's more of a question, I'm afraid, and it's a question that shows my ignorance. I've always assumed that the reference to consensus policy was to how the policy was developed, as opposed to that something that's consensus policy automatically applies to every registry, for example. But a lot of people here are much older hands at this than I am. So the reason I'm asking that is because it seems to me like that there might actually be, we might be talking at sort of cross purposes. Are we talking about should this become consensus policy, which implies that at the moment the development of the URS has something less than a policy status, or should the URS apply to legacy TLDs, which may be a slightly different question. And just to explain a bit more what I mean, the policy in relation to new GTLD talks about the need for the introduction of new GTLDs not to infringe the rights of third parties, and that was the policy. And then there was obviously a lot of work then done in relation to that policy involving an enormous amount of community efforts, extensive public comments and so on. And so whilst the URS may not have a kind of formal status of consensus policy, I don't think there's any doubt that it went through a very rigorous development process involving, multiple comment periods. So I'm just trying to understand whether the use of the word consensus policy here is actually causing some confusion and making things more difficult for people than is necessary. But I'm hoping someone can clarify for me and help me understand.
Okay, this is Kathy. Phil writes in the chat, right now the URS is an implementation detail of the new GTLD program and does not apply to legacy TLDs as a mandate. That's the current status. Neither does the Sphere know that the trademark claims or the trademark clearinghouse. They don't apply to legacy TLDs. But the question you raise, and we've now heard it several times, is a really important one. So may I suggest, and especially we're at 232, but also this is not a question that should be answered standing on one foot. May I suggest to the co-chairs, so if you have an objection, yell, please, that we work with staff to come up with kind of a historical timeline of what we, what's happened and, what's consensus policy versus, where these things stand. These are all important phrases and not used as much in the old days as we do now. So the legacy, the time, let's put together, a page summary so that we can talk about it together. I think that might be the best way to do this because there is history here and we do need to sit down and talk. The questions are great. Any objections to that? Then thank you, everyone, for staying on for this very long call. It's this excellent discussion as we went through the rest of the material in this document. Thank you for capturing the notes and for the future edits that will come through on the document. Look forward to talking with everyone next week. Staff, could you tell us what time our call is next week?
Hi, Kathy. It's Terry. I also put it in the chat as well. It'll be on Wednesday the 17th at 1800 UTC for 90 minutes.
Terrific. So same time as this week, and that puts our late night meeting, our Asia-friendly meeting, at the end of the month where it normally goes. Thank you very much, everyone. Thanks for a great call. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day. Operator Harvey, if you could please stop all recordings.